and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is Maverick director Russ Meyer. Born in 1922, Russell Albion Meyer was the product of a broken home, his father having abandoned the family almost as soon as Russ was born. When he turned 14, Russ's mother pawned her wedding dress to buy her son an 8mm camera, which he would use to make a series of amateur films. His skills behind the camera would serve him well when he joined the Army during World War II as a member of the 166th Signal Photo Company. Meyer would develop strong bonds with its fellow GIs, friendships that would last for the rest of his life. Despite being on the front lines, Meyer showed a willingness to risk his life to get great footage, and some of his work would end up in newsreels and even in 1970s patent. Unable to get work as a cinematographer after the war, Meyer made industrial films and shot glamour photography, including some for the brand new magazine Playboy. In one of the greatest examples of right place, right time in American history, Meyer's unabashed interest in the female form would come into play in his first film as director, 1959's The Immoral Mr. Tease. Starring one of his army buddies and shot with no sound, Tease featured a chaplain-esque figure as he encounters one nude woman after the next. Despite the film being banned in several markets, Tease would go on to make over $1 million on a $24,000 budget. And since Meyer owned the film, he reaped the lion's share of the profits. Meyer would crank out film after film in the 1960s, ranging from other nudie cuties such as 1961's Eve and the Handyman and 1962's Wild Gals of the Naked West. He moved into his black and white gothic period with 1964's Lorna, 1965's Motor Psycho, and 1965's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which, while not a moneymaker at the time, would go on to achieve iconic status. He continued to write, edit, direct, and distribute his films. And after a few box office failures, he struck gold with 1968's Vixen, starring bombshell Erica Gavin, whose character beds down everyone she meets, including her own brother. The first film to be given an X rating for its sex scenes, Vixen cost $75,000 to make and made over $8 million. That got the attention of 20th Century Fox. Fox, awash in red ink due to a series of expensive old-school flops, was looking for someone, anyone, who might connect with the burgeoning youth market. Despite the controversy, they hired Meyer to direct Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, an in-name-only sequel to the massively successful Valley of the Dolls. Meyer knew this film had to count, so he reached out to a writer who seemed to appreciate his work when many others did not, film critic Roger Ebert. Ebert and Meyer would write the script for Dolls and were essentially left alone on the Fox lot to make their movie. And boy, did they. A rock and roll sex comedy thriller musical, Dolls was unlike anything Hollywood had ever seen, and it was a giant hit. Fox signed Meyer to a three-picture deal, but unfortunately, that's when things went south. After considering films in other genres, Meyer let himself be talked into directing the courtroom drama The 7 Minutes about a banned book. Featuring very little of the trademark Meyer nudity, the decidedly square 7 Minutes flopped. Meyer, mad at himself for being talked into what he would later realize was unsuitable material, went back to independent filmmaking, never making another studio film. After the exploitation slave drama Blacksnake failed to connect, he returned to, quote, big bosoms and square jaws with 1975's Super Vixens, a huge hit despite, or because, an increased amount of violence mixed in with the sex. Things got even weirder with 1976's Up, which opens with a disguised Adolf Hitler participating in an orgy and stars the absurdly proportioned Kitten Natividad as a naked Greek chorus. Meyer tried to reteam with Ebert for a film about and starring the Sex Pistols, but it was shut down 2 days into shooting due to lack of funds. Meyer would make one last feature, 1977's Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens, again starring Natividad. With Meyer's type of sex picture now seeming tame, he struggled to get projects off the ground, finally settling on managing his legacy with the release of his films on home video. Since Meyer owned all of his non-studio work, it ensured that he would continue to be a very wealthy man. Living long enough to see his films become revered classics, Meyer passed away in 2004. Here with me to discuss Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens and the career of Russ Meyer is actor, director, producer, film programmer, and self-described pervert, Julia Marchesi. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
I hope you don't mind that intro.
We're going to get right into it, my friend. You might as well, right? You
know? I took it from your Instagram page. I'm like, she wrote it. It must be okay. So I'll throw that in there.
It must be okay. Yes. When a non-pervert ask to talk about the legacy of Russ Meyer, because I don't think so, you know?
Well, that's, yeah, well, that leads exactly to kind of what we wanted to start off with was, and I'll pull back the curtain for everybody a little bit here, is that I listen to your horror podcast that you do, and
Thank you.
I've seen your documentary out of print. I own it. It's fantastic.
Thank you. All right. And, physical media.
Yes. And I wanted to have you on the show, and I just, as I do to my guests, I say, let me know who you want to talk about. And you sent me an eclectic list. Corey Haim,
yes,
Divine,
mm-hmm.
director Stuart Gordon,
mm-hmm.
and Russ Meyer, which would be the most amazing dinner party, you know, of all time if you could have amassed those four people
God.
Together.
But I would be the happiest buddy that ever buddied. Oh my God, that would be the best.
So I contemplated that list, and I looked at their final films, and as I mentioned on the show before, I use this show to teach myself about a career that I don't know a whole lot about. And to the point that you had suggested Russ Meyer, I'd only seen two of his movies, his most famous ones, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and Faster Pussycat. And I realized, I don't really know anything about this guy. I know who he is. I remember working at Movies Unlimited, and his famous, all his films were boxed, had graphic design that made them look, you know, were specific to Russ Meyer. So I remembered these bright red boxes. I don't know who this mm-hmm. Russ Meyer guy is, but he must have been somebody, because he's got a kind of, you know, an oeuvre here at Movies Unlimited. And so I was like, well, let's talk about Russ Meyer. So I went in and dug in and watched a bunch of his films. He made a lot of movies,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them are hard to find. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I got to ask you, why Russ Meyer, and what was your introduction to him, his filmography?
My introduction to Russ Meyer was in college. My best friend Marion and I went to the library. I went to UC Irvine, and they had a great film selection there that we used to go on the weekends and just watch movies. And it's just the title, right? I'm like, oh, what is this? Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill? That sounds incredible. Yes, I want to watch that. I knew nothing. I went in totally blind, and it blew my mind. And I think that that's such a great... Faster Pussycat is the one I always show to people first, because I feel that's like dipping your toes in, right? It's almost family friendly in as far as Russ Meyer goes, right? Because it's not, there's no actual nudity,
right?
It's just girls kind of being kick ass, go go gang girl awesomeness, right? And so that was like, oh, this is awesome. And then, you know, delve. And then I feel like this is very similar. So I'm also a John Waters fan, which should not surprise you. And also, John Waters also loves Russ Meyer, but
yeah, big fan of Russ Meyer himself. Yeah,
of course. So also a pervert. so I saw Hairspray when I was a kid, and then I was like, oh, John Waters, I like this guy. And then I watched Pink Flamingos, and I was like, Jesus, man. Okay, I waited in this crate. That was a hard left. So I feel it was the same way. And Super Vixens is one of my favorites, and I actually have had a Super Vixens poster on my wall since college, the same one that has like moved with me, and it's on my keychain, and it's partially, it's just like the aesthetic of it is like, this is kind of this very specific space and time of my personal aesthetic. So a lot of what I like about Russ Meyer is the way his movies are styled, and the girls especially, because I'm a big fan of John Waters, Hair Hopper, like the bigger the hair, right? We got like these big, everything's so huge in his movies, and it's just sort of glamorous. So from there, it just became I just, you know, the thing that I really like about it, and this is actually, I'm going to quote this off the top here, because this is from the narration of Pandora Peaks, which I'm sure we'll talk about later,
yeah,
the documentary. But he says, watching a Russ Meyer film is like losing all notions of decency and good taste in one fell swoop, plus having an inordinately good time in the process. So I feel like that pretty much sums it up, right? Like you go in and it's... The thing that I like about him, and this is, I guess, also applicable to John Waters, is this feeling of I'm doing it myself. This is an independent film. And the thing that I most love about filmmaking is to have a filmmaker where you can see a minute of the film and be like, that's a Russ Meyer movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that 100%, even with the sound off. You don't even need a soundtrack.
Right.
And you'd be like, it's a Russ Meyer movie, right? It's even, you give me 5 seconds and I'll be able to tell. Like his editing style and his narration, and you know, you think of someone who didn't have a traditional film knowledge. You know, he learned on the battlefield. So the way he's learning to film is not the way that, you know, and I feel like he was actually really ahead of the curve as far as his editing. His editing is really fast. And you're thinking about, like, it feels fast now. And I'm like, you feel like it feels fast in the 1970s. He's going in this whole other direction. So he has this, there's this world that he builds that I feel like is unlike any other filmmakers. And I feel like all of his movies take place in the same universe. So I feel like there's so many that take place in the desert. And like, you just pan over, here's Fast and Pussycat, you pan over, and here's a part of Super Vixens, and here's right. a part of this. They're all in the same, they're all happening like simultaneously, which I love. And actually, if you were to ask me, if there was any, out of every movie I've ever seen in my life, which movie universe would I most like to live in? It would be Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. That's the universe I wish I lived in. So you can say a lot about a person by that. What is yours?
Oh, Lord. I don't think I'm prepared for that question. I will say this. It had not occurred to me until you just said it, that Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which is, again, like one of the great titles, right? Just ever of movies. It's just that name is like,
yes.
It's like that Pauline Kael quote. The Kill Kill Bang Bang is like, that's what movies are. Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is like the side avenue of that. It's just everything you want in a movie. You're like, wow, it sounds awesome and sexy and it's got death in it. And oh boy. But it's so funny when you think about that, like The Immoral Mr. Tease, which I mentioned in the intro, right? That's his first film. That's 1959. Mm-hmm. That's 6 years before Faster Pussycat. That has nudity in it. And that is not a movie you would just show to anybody. And then a couple of years, actually just 2 years by the time he gets to Vixen, that's full of nudity. But you've got this window where he's making those, as I put it, like the gothic dramas that are kind of not that. And Faster Pussycat is, in its own weird way, the most family-friendly Russ Meyer movie you're going to have, because, as you said, there is no nudity in it.
Yeah, I was actually, I've been video store, speaking of. So my first job was at a video store, Video Time, and I've been volunteering at Vidiots here in LA. They just had a screening of Pink Flamingos, which seeing it with a crowd was fantastic. The noises of disgust were joyous. but I was trying to convince them to put Faster Pussycat on in the video store, like as a like, hey, you're coming over for John Waters, and they wouldn't do it. And I'm like, there's some punching. There's some go-going. Like, there's some stabbing, you know, but it's not like I'm asking to put Super Vixens on. I mean,
right. I love the idea.
They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. And good for them, because they shouldn't. It's a bad idea.
I do like the idea of everything taking place in the same universe, because you can imagine Tura Satana is crushing that guy with her car. And then if you just pan a little over, what Charles Napier is exploding out in the desert, you know, like, so you can sort of see all that.
And it's something like a similar to like a Wes Anderson thing, right? Like I feel like all Wes Anderson movies kind of take place in that same universe, no matter where they are. I like that about a filmmaker. I think that's a cool idea that it feels that way to us.
I found in my research for this episode, I found a clip of Russ Meyer. I read, you know, saw a bunch of interviews with him, but apparently he made an appearance on Conan O'Brien in the 90s. And it, you know, I don't know why. I don't know what he was promoting. I mean, but he comes on and he runs a clip of Faster Pussycat. Okay. And it's really fun to watch, because the audience is just, they're laughing, but they're kind of, you could tell they're like, what? Like what? Because, you know, this is network television, you know, and here's baby-faced Conan O'Brien. And then we're cutting to Tura Satana killing a guy by running. Like, it just feels like that movie is beamed in from another universe.
It is.
You know?
Yeah, it is. And that it's so incredibly unique. And I, you know, there are many things about his films I don't like. The things that I do like, and the genius of it, and the joyful bits of it that I really much, you know, really do enjoy, is so him. And I think that's what's cool about it. Like, I want it, when I watch your film, I want to see you in there. And there is 100%, this is Russ Meyer, take it or leave it, right? Like, he's letting you know exactly what's going on. And I think that, you know, I understand he's quite a gentleman, but also you have stuff like Faster Pussycat, where you're like, no other person on the planet was going to make that movie. That was in nobody else's head but that guy, and we got to see it.
One of the most amazing things, I think, when you look at Russ Meyer's filmography is, I mean, again, and I watch as many of them as I could, was, I think, kind of the amazement that it was almost like, where did he find these women? You know, like, where did, because each, almost each film he's found some very unique looking person who really doesn't like, if they were ever in another movie, they would stick out like a sore thumb because they would just be so like, what is that person? So, I mean, you've got, I already mentioned Tura Santana, Edie Williams, Erica Gavin, Kit Natividad, who I mentioned, Lorna Maitland, Uschi DeGard, Haji, Sherry Eubank. Like, these are, I mean, obviously one of the things they have in common is their proportions.
Of course.
You know, and something I thought that was amazing, again, was reading a bunch of interviews with Russ Meyer over the years, where he was very upfront about what he liked.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I like big-breasted women. That yes, is what I like.
That's quite clear from his filmography,
right?
Sir. That's
you know, but I mean, it's like, it's almost like, I think as he started becoming more regarded as a filmmaker, I feel like interviewers were like, well, there must be another layer to this guy because he can't. And then he was sort of forcing it like, no, I just really like big-breasted women. And that's what I want to see on screen. And that's what makes money. And at the same time, as you're talking about, his directing style is so unique. His editing style is so unique. And it reminds me a little bit, there's a quote from Martin Scorsese's A Personal Journey documentary that he did, where he quotes John Ford, where apparently John Ford was at some conference with other directors, and he introduced himself saying, I'm John Ford and I make Westerns, which was sort of like, in Scorsese's telling, Ford's way of kind of cutting the like, I'm not some highfalutin artist. I make Westerns. Even though you're like, well, John Ford, you're one of the great directors and you've made lots of things, but he wanted to think, you know, be perceived as, I'm a guy who makes Westerns. And it's in a weird way, it's like Russ has this artistic bent, but yet he didn't want to talk about that in his interviews. He's just like, no, I really like big boobed women. And that's what I want to show on screen. And that's it. And he was very, very upfront about it.
But he has these women that, you know, are such, you know, you look at Tura Santana, who is a force of nature. Where was her giant movie star career? Because I would watch her do anything. I would watch her do anything. She could be the villain in any movie and I would watch that. She could be anything. She's incredible. And you think of these, you know, they're taking these characters and making them into these like iconic figures, right? They're not only because obviously they're stunning, but just this force of kind of an unreality, an absurdity. Like it doesn't take place. And I think that's kind of what I like about it, is even when he's trying to be real, it doesn't feel like we're living. And, you know, he always talks about like his movies are kind of real life cartoons, and that's how they kind of feel to me. Like, they don't feel real. There is, you know, Super Vixens is hard because there's the bathtub stomping scene in the beginning. That's really brutal. And brutal. I really don't like it. And, you know, and like, it's the kind of thing, like, I have another podcast called Jodorowsky. That's all about Alejandro Jodorowsky. I bet you didn't think he'd be talking about Jodorowsky in a Russ Meyer episode, did you?
Dropping all sorts of names in this episode.
But here we are. But it was similar. Like, Jodorowsky has an unsavory thing for killing animals in his movies. And I hate it. And I hate that he does it. But those movies are fucking brilliant. And I have to kind of like mentally skip past it. And we're on to the next. So I feel like Super Vixens is a hard one to show to people for that. Like, once you get past this, it's kind of okay. And it's like that, I feel like that one is the one that the most that kind of ricochets between. And I think that one is, I think the only one I can think of that really crosses the line where I'm really, really like, please stop. It's really uncomfortable. But the rest of the movie is joy. You know, it's like, what do you do? I don't know. And that's the hard thing about talking about art, is that, you know, it's going to, you know, obviously his art is meant, it offends a lot of people, and a lot of his art is meant to offend you, and like, he's trying to offend you in a lot of different ways. And I feel like that's part of what I like about it. I think it's, you know, obviously I would love to see that Russ Meyer Sex Pistols movie more than anything in the goddamn world. And I think that the thing that would make it work is because Russ Meyer's fucking punk rock and he does it himself and he doesn't care what you think. And he's, you know, he also feels very angry. So I feel like that is very similar to that punk rock aesthetic. So I think Roger Ebert, I don't know how he would fit in that, but that's okay. That's okay. I do feel Russ Meyer is quite punk.
It was interesting that people, you know, when Russ came along, when he did, that he made very hip films. Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is like the hippest thing imaginable. It gave birth to the line, you know, this is my happening and it freaks me out, which probably a whole generation of people think is from Austin Powers, you know, because that's where, you know, it was in that movie.
Sure.
But he was not a hippie. He was not. He was a very old school guy, very old school. And in fact, you know, one of the things I did in preparation for the show was I read this biography about him called Big Bosoms and Square Jaws by Jimmy McDonough, which was just an absolutely terrific read. I tore through it. But he was very, you know, anyone he didn't like was a commie. That was his, like, no matter whether they were really even there was even any like a political aspect to their personality, they were commies. They were, you know, and so he was an old, but yet he was also, as you say, he didn't give a fuck, you know, he didn't. And that made him different from his generation. And that's what he became. He was able to make a film as hip as Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. But you wouldn't imagine when you see the guy, like, oh, that's the guy that's making these movies? Because he doesn't look like what you would imagine. He didn't look like, you know, Hal Ashby in 1968. Kind of. He's not a hippie. You know what I mean? He's like a big guy and he's kind of garrulous. So, no, you know, you mentioned the stomping scene in Super Vixens, right? And that is tough to watch. Mm-hmm. It is brutal and it goes on forever. And he shoots it really well. I mean, he really puts it across of how the, you know, just how awful it is. What do you make of the increasing violence in the films as they go on? Because, you know, one of the themes that people that are even remotely familiar with his films know that all the women in his movies are, they have agency. You know, they are mostly very horny. They want to have sex and there's no sort of moral judgment about that. They pursue sex, and all the men in his movies are weak, timid. They can't satisfy their women. And the only other ones that are not that are very violent, almost caveman like guys. So in some of his movies, the women are subjected to pretty brutal violence. I mean, the first film I watched after having seen the two that I mentioned that I saw years ago. So like the first one I watched for this episode was Up,
okay,
which has Raven St. Croix in it, the absolutely stunning Raven St. Croix. And, you know, she gets raped in that movie like three times. And I was like, what? Whoa, you know, and some of it played for laughs a little bit, like the music is kind of. And so what do you make of that, of that? There's all this sort of joyful, aggressive sex, and then, you know, these hard right turns, as you say, into some pretty brutal violence.
I guess to bring it back to Jodorowsky, I guess I feel like it feels the same. You know, when I talk about The Holy Mountain, which I think is one of the most brilliant films ever made, I feel like it's an incredible watch, but it's an intense watch because it tries to show you kind of everything in the human experience, everything that is beautiful and everything that is awful, and lets it, you kind of make what you will out of all of that. And I feel like this is the same. It goes to, you know, there's so many like slide whistles and crazy sound effects, and like it really does feel like you're watching a cartoon. It's so like fast, and then you're getting this brutality. It feels out of place because when I watch a cartoon, I kind of want, give me some fun violence, give me like, you know, the anvil hits you and then your head is anvil shaped, like that's kind of what I want. And so when it goes, you know, because like I feel like the Faster Pussycat violence feels like that.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like she breaks a guy's spine with her foot and it's pretty fucking impressive, but I'm not like, you know, I'm like, yeah, like you're kind of impressed by it. And this, that, you know, the scenes, they just, you know, there's bits of this as, and especially I think as he gets older, they just feel meaner. And I don't know what was going on with inside that man's head. You know, I know that war does really terrible things to people, and I know that he probably saw and filmed some terrible things. And if this is the way to get it out, I guess that's that, you know, a healthy way to do it, you know, with art, I guess. But I, you know, because he seems to have like come back from the war and just gone straight back into it. He didn't, and I can't even imagine, you know, war is the most horrific thing I could think of. And I'm glad that he doesn't bring it into his films more. I guess we got the German stuff all the time. And this
Martin
is
Martin Bormann like, in every
and this is the, you know, I forget, like I'm very good at selectively watching a film and kind of editing out the bits if I don't like in my head. Like there's a movie that came out in the 90s called Swing Kids, which I was super, super into. Robert Sean Leonard and Christian Bale swing dancing, like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your whole life. But it's about Nazis, right? that I can watch it and be like, it's about cute boys dancing. And they're like, it's not though. It's really about Nazis. And like, I see it, and yet I can kind of go, oh, it's okay. We'll just edit that out mentally.
I guess that would help, right? If you're watching his films. I mean, they are, again, aside from the violence, which I just mentioned, they are, joyful in their own way, in that everyone is just pursuing carnal delights and, very lustily so. And they're not, the characters aren't really shamed for it. The movie isn't putting them down. I do love that in so many of his movies, at the very end, there will be some moral that the narrator is just reading out to you at the end, as it was sort of like, all right, I gotta mention this. Like, all right, we gotta talk about how these people led these sad lives. But his heart's not really in it. Like, we just like, wait a minute, you've been showing me 90 minutes of the most exciting, amazing stuff imaginable, and now you're kind of like scolding the characters in the last 90 seconds. Like, no, come on, and
No.
it's that's not really working. So, I mean, like I said, when I watched Up, which was again the first one I watched as in the last month, that one was not a great one to start with, because it is so, I mean, I mentioned it opens with Adolf Hitler in disguise, and it has a Martin Foreman character, and
Can you just pause for a second, though, and just think about that? Like, this is the scene that comes to your head when you're like, I'm going to open my next movie. You know what scene I'm going to open with? With this. But who does that? Why would you do that? Everybody, I mean, you are going to make a giant what the fuck the whole audience immediately. And like, I guess you're throwing people off, but it's ballsy. And you could say that about all of his stuff, right? Like, you're like, ooh, you go hard, man.
Right. I mean, you think about, like, he's obviously, I'm sure a lot of the people that saw his films in the theater were seeing them purely for the titillation factor, because he knew they were going to have, the people knew they were going to have a lot of nudity and a lot of sex. But he's throwing in lots of stuff that, if that was all he was interested in, he could have done that wall to wall, but he doesn't.
Right.
He throws in these weird digressions about this character or that character, I mean, and so it's like, that's obviously what's on his mind. And it's like, as you were saying, they are incredibly distinctive, right? They are just incredibly distinctive. So, of the ones that do you have particular favorites among his oeuvre? That's a
I
fancy
mean,
word.
Faster Pussycat, number one. Love Super Vixens, but Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is where it's at. I feel like that's really the kind of masterpiece of crazy 60s insanity. And I actually, so I was at Bob's Big Boy last year, and I looked over and John Lazar was standing there, and I went completely involuntarily blurted out, oh my God, you're Z-Man. And he looked over and he was like, hey. And I was like, hey. And I was so excited. And we had a very nice conversation about Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And he came over and said goodbye to me when he was leaving. And then it
Oh.
was just my birthday the other day. And he messaged me happy birthday on
Oh my
Facebook.
goodness.
So I felt pretty good about that.
That's marvelous.
He's
That
very
is
nice.
well, I have the Blu-ray of that, and there's two commentary tracks on it. One is by Roger Ebert, because I mentioned he co-wrote the movie, and Ebert always did great commentaries. He didn't do that many of them, and so I was like, well, but then there's the other commentary track with the whole cast, and he's there with everybody, and they're having such fun talking about the movie, telling stories, making fun of each other, and it's really delightful. It's really charming to hear these people get together 50 years after they made this film and still have such warm memories to it. So that's great. I love that he was so that he embraced that so much, and was, kind of thrilled to be recognized for that, even though that's probably, obviously the only thing he's really going to be recognized for, but that's really charming.
Well, it's a cult film for a reason, I feel like. And this is one that I'm in. For me, musicals are my favorite. I love film in all its forms, as we know, but horror and musicals are my favorite. So the fact that this one is a musical really like kicks it up a notch for me. And just the fashion and the slang that you can tell. Because the thing is like I love Roger Ebert, but he's not the hippest of people, right? So he's writing what he thinks cool people talk like, but not
Right.
necessarily what they would talk like. But I think that this it works completely, and I love this. I love the script. I will say, I would love to. I don't know. I think it's so much fun and weird, and like what because I love Valley of the Dolls, the book that's the original book. I love the movie. And then it comes from, like, it's just this weird, it feels like it doesn't belong in this universe, right? Like, it just, like, it's impressive, actually, that Russ Meyer was able to make a studio film, go to the studio, and they then make a movie that feels so incredibly Russ Meyer. Because
right.
normally when that happens, an independent filmmaker goes to a studio, and now they just feel like a studio director. Like, you can't
yep.
really tell it's them anymore. And this is like, oh, no, nothing has changed. You've just given me more money, and now it's going to look cleaner, and now we're going to get up there and have a good time. I've never watched that movie without having a blast with the people I'm with. Seeing it in a theater is so much fun. It's such a weird one. What do you think about it?
Oh, I mean, it is a blast, and it is crazy. I love Edie Williams in it. Edie is just like this, you know, like sexual vampire, you know, like she's
Mm-hmm.
just like, she's just kind of on the prowl and sort of devouring men. And it's the kind of thing where I can enjoy it from a distance, but it's like, I wouldn't want to meet that person. It's like, she kind of terrifies me. When I was watching it again, and I hadn't seen it in a really long time, so I rewatched it. And there was something, another quote that came to mind as I was watching it. And this quote, keep dropping all these different names, but there's a quote from the commentary track to The Thing from John Carpenter. And he's there with Kurt Russell. And he mentions at the end, because that was his studio film, and he said, when you're working at a major studio, and he says, if they're behind you, he says, there is nothing better. He says, when they're really on your side, he said, that is the best any director is ever going to have, because you have the resources you need and you're not scraping by and just having to steal shots. And, you know, I can only shoot this guy for 4 days because I've only got $80,000.
Right.
And you know, and the thing bombed and that caused a bunch of problems. But it's, as you were saying, it's like you would imagine Russ Meyer doing a studio film would be a recipe for disaster. Which kind of what the next film, The 7 Minutes, really became. But no, in some ways, it's the most Russ Meyer-y movie. It's got lots of sex in it.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of nudity.
Yeah.
And it's got crazy violence. And it structurally, it's I mean, the movie opens with the end and then winds its way all the way through the story back to the place where it started. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, good Lord, there is a beheading scored to the 20th Century Fox fanfare, you know, like imagine the letting them do it. Two of the women are dressed as Robin and Catwoman, and they are wearing the actual costumes from the Batman TV show because they were on the lot. They were on the Fox lot. The studios are just like, we don't know what we're doing. We're making Dr. Doolittle here. Nobody's seen these movies. So let this guy just make his movie. And they did. And it really is just like, wow, what a once in a lifetime opportunity. And as you know, I mentioned in the intro, he knew it. Like he knew this had to score. This had to, and that's why he reaches out to Ebert, even though, as you said, he was not known as Mr. Hip, but it was that Ebert wrote a nice column about him and was appreciative of Meyer's work. And Meyer's, you know, felt like, hey, there's somebody who actually knows what I'm doing here. But it really, it is just such a strange one-off that you can, yes, yeah, probably could never be duplicated again, because after that, the studio is going to clamp down, right? And
yes,
they're going to
exactly.
do what you're talking about. They're going to be like, they're going to sand the edges down because now there's real money to be made here.
Yeah, and this is the thing. It's like all anybody wants is for the studios to give directors money and leave them alone.
Right.
Just give them
right.
the money and don't do anything. I feel like I've heard that that's kind of like the Netflix deal. Is like that's the carrot they're dangling in front of you, right? It's like, we give you the money, we leave you alone. Is that true? We don't know. But yes, very impressive. But also, I feel like the 7 minutes is, I like it. I don't like, it's not a Russ Meyer. It is a Russ Meyer movie. That's the weird thing about it, though. Kind of is and it isn't. Like, he's trying to, and I don't know. I feel like the Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is the most Russ Meyer movie. I feel like, definitely. And I would recommend it to anybody, alone or at a party, because it works both ways.
Oh, I can imagine putting it on at a party would be, it's a fantastic party movie.
Yes,
not just
so,
because there's party scenes, but just because it's, you don't know where it's going. You know, it just zips from thing to thing. Like, yeah, it moves at a brisk clip, you know.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a script that I've written that's a kind of a Russ Meyer homage in trying to turn, you know, angle it in a way that's not as aggro. I guess. Not as just as pervy, but not as aggro. I feel like there's a it's the you know it's Russ Meyer filtered through my brain, right? Who wouldn't want to see that? Quaalude kittens, if that title doesn't intrigue you, I don't know what will. It's bisexual, and tagline is now sexploitation swings both ways. So, I think the world's ready for it.
You feel like, is there, this is a little bit off subject, and I don't, I want to get too far for us, but like part of the thing I think nowadays that we see with films is like nobody's really offensive anymore because they don't want to take the heat for it. Like, you know what I mean? Like Russ wasn't worried. I mean, it was a different time, obviously, but like Russ, some of Russ Meyer's films are genuinely offensive. Genuinely offensive. I mean, Erica Gavin in Vixen, it calls the African American character in that movie the what just the worst
Yeah, but
racist names
he's
throughout the whole film.
and it but it's trying to bait you, right? That's the whole
Right.
point of it, right? It's a John Waters movie. It's trying to make the audience squeal in disgust. That's part of the fun of it, I guess. It's like it's something like, I guess I look at something like Harold and Maude, which I feel similar, speaking of Hal Ashby, right? It's like, how did that movie get made, right? You look at that, you're like, that movie should never have been made. That movie's insane. It's amazing. And I feel like that's probably another thing where they're like, oh, yeah, we can't let you do that again. That was way too
Right.
far, right? Like, we're gonna pull that back. Even though I think it's perfect the way it is. And I feel like I see what you're saying about now, is that there is a level of squeamishness now about people not wanting to, and I feel like it's valid, right? Like, nobody wants to hurt anybody else's feelings, just be nice. But also, John Waters and Russ Meyer, I don't know how to parse those two things.
Yeah, I mean it's like people, I think now again I don't want to get too far off Russ Meyer, but like I feel like nowadays people don't they don't enjoy, I don't want to say they don't enjoy being offended. Of course they don't. That's what offended really is, but it's there's just something about watching when I was watching the Russ Meyer movies, I'm not so jaded that I wasn't at some point during Up or during Super Vixens or Vixen that I was like I didn't go, "Whoa, whoa, wow." You know, just kind of, oh, that really just happened in a movie that presumably had a wide audience. And I just think like I can't imagine anybody doing that nowadays because they would just, well, first of all, no studio would bankroll it. That's the other thing. But just it was this kind of like, yeah, he went for it. And I guess that people kept coming back because it was
Well,
like, this guy's just gonna, what's this crazy thing I got gonna do next?
and for the most part, the studios weren't bankrolling it, right? That's the whole point of it. He can be as offensive as he liked
That's true.
because nobody's bankrolling that. And I think that's the kind of, the thing that I like about him is like he had control over his whole career, more or less, and decided exactly what he was going to do and how he was going to do it. Even I think a little bit to the detriment, because so I used to work at the New Beverly Cinema. And because I love Russ Meyer, I always wanted to program his movies, and it was prohibitively expensive. We couldn't do it. We couldn't afford it. Like, was charging three times the price as much as anybody else, any studio would charge. So I think that they're getting a little bit better about it now and realizing that people want to really see his work. But I feel like there was this kind of divide of like, oh, you may have to, I know you want to make money at it, but you also have to kind of, people want to see it, and you're making it. And also for now, like, you can't get a lot of his stuff streaming. So where is that, right? Like, and this is, obviously I have a big VHS collection. I love physical media, and there's something to be said for it to have a physical copy and be like, I got my copy of Motorcycle back there. It's not going nowhere. My copy of Lorna safe on that shelf. So, trying to find most of his stuff is hard to do.
Yeah, I had that in my notes here of like when I was doing research that Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is the only one that's streaming anywhere. I found Faster Pussycat Kill Kill on YouTube for Pete's sakes. But yeah, a lot of them are very, very hard to find. And Jimmy McDonough in his book gets into this a little because he talks about Russ Meyer's later years where it seemed like he was, as he got older, was suffering from some level of dementia or turning senile a little bit. And he put his sort of his life in the hands of this assistant who kind of went from an office assistant to sort of running his life. And then she started putting up walls around him, so even his old friends couldn't get to see him. And there was some, it was genuinely sad to read that there was this, it seemed a little like elder abuse, is that this guy didn't know what he was doing. And then she brought in this other guy to run the films, to own the films, and They're on DVD. There was a box set, but those are long out of print. Some of them are insanely expensive to find. And I have to think, yeah, that's like, these things should be more available. It is sad that they're, this is a guy who had made some amazing films, and you're, other than the most famous one, they're virtually impossible to find for anyone who's not going to get frustrated after, like, all right, I can't, I don't, I, what am I don't know where these things are. And then just sort of give up, which is tragic.
Yeah. And I went on his website to see you can buy his autobiography there. Huge three volumes.
The $300 autobiography.
$600.
$600 now. Oh my God.
Yeah. Because this one's autographed by him. So, I mean, I'm sure there's not many, but yeah, I think they'll come around eventually. I hope, you know, but I think it's something that, you know, but, you know, it's also going back to physical media, like the video stores, like Vidius has them, like you can go find them. But I think that there is something, as former video store clerks ourselves, knows the joy of the hunt. And that is something, mm-hmm. you know, a physical hunt is much more fun than a looking online hunt.
Yes.
But I would like people to be able to see his work more freely, for sure.
At the video store that I worked at, Movies Unlimited, we had a soft adult section. And within that section, there was a shelf devoted to Russ Meyer. And, you know, that, first of all, the idea that you would have someone who was enough of an auteur to have his films collected in the soft adult section says something. You know, I mean, that's something, we're not talking about, like, you get John Ford or Orson Welles. We're talking about a guy that made skin flicks, and yet there was enough of them and enough of a cohesive vision to collect them together. And I've told the story on other film related podcasts. And it's perfect because we're talking about Russ Meyer, is that one time I was working at the store, and a guy came in, and he was in town for business. He was from Texas, but he was in town because we were right across the river from Philadelphia. So he was in Philadelphia for some conference. And this guy looked like the Rich Texan character from The Simpsons. Giant cowboy hat, big, you know, I mean, like, and he was like, how y'all doing? I mean, like an absolute straight out of Central Casting kind of guy. And he comes up to me and he says, hi, you know, how you doing? And he could not have been nicer. He said, how you doing there, son? Like, you know, he said, I'm looking for this movie. Really hard to find. Maybe you guys have it. Well, you know, I'll look it up for you. What are you looking for? It's called, this is the title, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And I said, oh, yeah, we have that. I said, that's in our Russ Meyer section. And this look came over. He goes, y'all have a Russ Meyer section? Like, he was so delighted that someone had loved the stuff enough. And I brought him over, and he was, I think he rented like six movies that night. He was so happy. And I'll never forget that, because he was just like, oh man, I miss that video store sometimes. You know,
it's, there you,
like,
go. It's the video store stuff.
Oh, we're never going to have that again.
I was at Video Time. That was my first video store job in Las Vegas, Nevada, TYME. And I got to, the movie that I pushed to everybody that summer was Say Anything, because everybody wanted to just like rent stupid new releases. And I was like, yes, but have you seen Say Anything? And I got many people to rent it, and everybody came back and liked it. So I felt like I did my job.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, when someone would come back with saying they love something you recommended, that was the
good
feeling. Great feeling.
I mean, and that tracks, right? Because I went right into film programming right at the New Beverly, right, where I'm watching. And this is but that's even better, because this is the joy of, I can watch people watch it. I can be in the theater and hear them watch it. You know, with video store, you're just sending them away. So I think that's the joy of it. You know that joy.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. So, okay. Well, let's talk about Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens a little bit, because as I mentioned, it is his last film. It was released in April of 1979. Now, trying to write out the plot of of any Russ Meyer film, especially the later ones where the editing got crazier and the storylines became even more disjointed, is a little bit of a fool's errand. But I'm going to do my best here to kind of summarize the film as fast as possible. So in small town USA, we are introduced to several sets of characters: evangelical radio preacher Eufala Roop, a door-to-door salesman, a woman named Junkyard Sal, and Lamar, a man who is only interested in having marital relations with his wife Livonia in one particular way, much to his wife's disinterest. There is also an unnamed man who serves as the narrator to all these stories. After Lamar forces himself on his wife, she beats him up and leaves. Later, Lamar goes to a bar where his wife is stripping under the name Lola Langusta. Lavonia drugs her husband and sleeps with him again, asking if he has changed his ways. In response, Lamar runs away. Lamar decides the only way to be cured is through faith. Lavonia drops him off at the radio station, and he goes off to sleep with other, and she goes off to sleep with other people, men and women. Eufaula and Lamar have sex, and while she remains preaching to her radio flock. Now cured, Lamar heads home and sleeps with Lavonia. Shortly thereafter, Eufaula has sex with a young man named Rhett, who we learn is the son of the narrator. The narrator returns home to find Rhett having sex with his father's new bride, whom he tells to stand aside so he can show his son how it's done. The film ends with our director, alone, carrying his camera equipment around a mountaintop, calling out for Kitten, and then a title card promising yet another Russ Meyer film. Like I said, that is not doing the film justice, just trying to describe what goes on in that movie. What do you think of Ultra Vixens?
It's bonkers. It feels similar to Super Vixens to me. That same kind of disjointed, what is happening? These characters are just insane. There is a plot, but there isn't a plot, right? Like, right. You're just, so it's kind of hard to like delve into, and what is the meaning behind it? I don't really know. It's just kind of following these weirdo characters around, and you can, I think, getting into the sexual politics of like what he's trying to say with it. I'm like, I got no clue, man. I don't know. Russ Meyer's brain is insane. Clearly not my brain, right? Like I got a brain that's not seeing what he's seeing. So, but that's kind of the joy of cinema, is everybody sees the same movie and yet does not see the same movie, right? It's filtered through your own lens. So I think I like Super Vixens better. I feel like I think these three are kind of in a little trifecta of similarity, but I feel like this one, I enjoyed it.
As you just said, like with Super Vixens and Up and Ultra Vixens especially, I felt like he's getting it's getting crazier and crazier in terms of how nothing is really hanging together. And he's not trying to. It's not like he's trying to and failing. He's not even trying to. I mean, the movie ends with Russ Meyer, who kind of comes out of nowhere, wandering the desert with a camera. And he yells and as I said, he yells out for Kitten, who plays Lavonia. I mean, he's just breaking that fourth wall and being like, hey, I'm looking for this. I'm looking for my actress here. By the way, I will say, just my own personal tastes, like my view of what I find attractive is not the same as Russ Meyer. Russ had a very specific, women had to have just absurd proportions. But I really do enjoy, but in both Up and this one, Kitten Natividad, because she's just sort of like joyful. Like she's just like a big, when she's running around and Up playing the naked Greek chorus and she's saying these nonsensical words, like there's just like an energy and a vibrancy to her that to me is just really fun to watch. Really enjoy. Agreed. Like she's just like having just a great time.
Yeah, she does. She really brings a life to screen. I have a VHS of, I believe it's late 90s, late 80s, Evening with Kitten. And it's just her, like you're just hanging out with her at her house in her lingerie. And then she's going to like show you some stuff. And it's pretty great.
I mean, the scene where her husband, Lamar, is like, he's going over some facts and figures and he's got like a calculator and he's sitting there working. And meanwhile, his wife is in the bedroom and he can see her from where he is sitting. And she is clearly trying to entice him into bed. And he's not paying attention to her, and to the point where she gets out some physical assistance, let's say, and pleasures herself. And loudly, and the classic camera shot through the bed springs, which he did in like virtually every film,
of course.
And meanwhile, we keep cutting to the husband, and he's sweating, and he just can't. And it's again, it's so funny that in every movie, and I don't want to make too much of the psychology of it, as you talk about that he didn't grow up with a father, he grew up with a very domineering, strong mother and a sister who suffered from a lot of mental illness that he had to take care of in later life. But it is so fun that in every one of his, virtually every one of his movies, the men are just the most weak-willed, and they're not sexless because they want to have sex, but like they only want to have sex on their terms, right? They only, like in this film, Lamar is interested in sex with his wife in one particular manner that she doesn't want to do. And outside of that, he's not even interested in her. And it's just so interesting that he, for a guy who in interviews sounds very unreconstructed, you know, like in interviews, he seemed to regard any sex other than like penetrative as like useless, you know, like why do that? You know, I mean, what would be the point? And yet in the, that's the opposite of what he's showing on screen, because the men in his movies are just zeros. And I find that really funny that he's the sort of backwards feminist filmmaker, because all the women in his movies are just so powerful.
Yeah, I know. That's it. Yeah, it's true.
And do you find, and forgive me this question, I don't mean it to be too invasive, but like, do you find any of his films particularly erotic? Right? Because he doesn't, I don't think he's trying to do that. He's, you know, and I'm imagining that the audiences that went to his films, they're probably hoping for some sort of eroticism, but that's not really what he's trying to do. The scene where Lamar and Lavonia go to the dentist and they end up pairing off with the dentist, basically tries to assault Lamar, and then the nurse gets it on with Lavonia, and it's like a dirty Mad magazine. Like there's no eroticism to it. It's just sort of craziness.
No, there's a lot of nudity and there's a lot of sex, but it doesn't feel particularly sexy.
Right.
But I feel like it's sexy some kind of in the way that like a music video is sexy, where the whole part of it doesn't need to be, but there can be 1 3-second shot where you're like, that fucking shot, right? Like there's just bits of it that are going to stick in your brain. And I think that's part of it. So there are like small shots and sequences, but for the most part, no, it's just goofy. It's goofy or it's, you know, kind of uncomfortable.
there's an opening scene where, again, Martin Borman, in every one of his movies, he had the same actor playing Martin Borman. But again, his war experiences are coloring his later films. But it opens with this guy who is he's hired this woman to sexually satisfy him. But instead, he covers himself in a sheet and lays in a coffin while she sort of gyrates alone, and he watches her and pleasures himself to that. And you're like, and he's like in a Nazi uniform, and you're like, what the hell is this? And then I learned, thanks to Jimmy McDonough's book, that is from a real life thing that he heard about from a stripper named Lily Lamont, who had a client who wanted that. And that's all that he wanted from her. And she said, he never touched me, but he dressed in like a Nazi uniform and put a sheet over his head and laid in a coffin and pleasured himself while I stripped. And
now think about how that guy felt when he watched that movie.
You imagine?
He was like, hey,
my kink is up there on screen for everybody to see.
Cause like, it's real specific. It's real specific.
Real specific. Right? I mean, that's about as specific as it gets.
I think that's what's fascinating about the human brain to me, that your brain can get that specific. To be like, I need to be in a coffin on wheels. I need to have a Nazi uniform. I need to have a sheet over me. I need to have a girl, but I don't want to touch the girl. Like your brain has gone through so many layers to get to that specific thing. It's fascinating. I'm like, how did that happen? I don't know. I don't kink shame at all. I think it's fucking fascinating. And the human brain is so complex. And Russ Meyer proves that, right? More than anybody.
Something else I wanted to mention is that for the most part, his actors, except for Charles Napier, who everyone knows, you know, again, for anyone listening, you may not know the name, you know the face. He is in a lot of Jonathan Demme movies. He's the head cop who finds out that Hannibal Lecter gets killed by Hannibal Lecter. He is the lead singer of the Good Old Boys in the Blues Brothers. He's in a lot of Russ Meyer films. But short of him and one or two others, most of the actors that are in Russ Meyer films did not go on to really much careers. Part of it is that he was hiring non-actors. A lot of the women, obviously, if your main goal of to put your woman in the film is that she's got to have like triple D, you know, whatever size breasts, well, you know, you got to pull from strip clubs. You're not going to find a lot of actresses that look like that. But I find it interesting that when I was looking at some of the filmographies of the actors in Ultra Vixens, like Anne Marie, who plays Eufaula, she's only in one other movie, Super Vixens, and that's it. Mm-hmm. These are the two movies she's in. June Mack, who plays Junkyard Sal, who died very young and was shot to death, unfortunately. This is her sole film. Ken Kerr, who plays Lamar, is only in Up in this film. And an exception to that is Steve Tracy, who plays the young son, Rhett. One of his other credits right around this time was 11 episodes of Little House on the Prairie.
Amazing. That makes me very happy. I hope he told some stories on the set of Little House. I hope Michael Landon was shocked.
Doing Ultra Vixens and then doing the squarest, most family-friendly show in history.
This is what acting is. But I don't know. I mean, I can see it from an actor's point of view in Hollywood, right? Like, you're talking about people who, you know, because I love that he goes to the strip club called The Losers to get these girls, because these girls are like the most, I can't, they're just, you know, perfection. You look at them, they're like, they're not human. How is that possible? How are you built like that? This doesn't exist. But you have all these, so let's say you have a friend who's a filmmaker, right? And they're like, oh, hey, I'm making this movie. I wrote this part for you. Come do this thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to go out and try to be an actor then, right? Like, you were just like, and then your friend comes along a couple years later. It's like, hey, I got another part for you. And you're like, cool. And you don't really have to do anything. It just kind of comes your way, falls in your lap, you do it, and that's that. But you don't really have to kind of put any work or try to find it. So I think that maybe a lot of it's that. It's like, oh, the work was fun when it was there and coming to me. Or maybe they're like, this maker movies are terrible, because a lot of people find that too. They're like, nope, not for me. Right. So, and I don't know how Russ Meyer makes movies, because it doesn't seem to be like everybody else's, but his, I'm sure, were pretty low budget and not very fancy and not for, you know, a lot of this is ladies out in the desert, you know, walking around in things that are going to be, you're like laying on a rock and you're naked and like, it just, you know, like, it doesn't look like it's going to be real fancy and fun. It looks like it's going to be, but it looks good on camera, but it's going to be probably really uncomfortable.
Yeah. They sound like tough shoots. And then he was a particularly kind of, he was so focused on getting the films. And in fact, you know, for people who, you know, only hear about these movies, you might imagine, oh, well, there must have been sex aplenty going on these sets, right? Because this is, they're making a sex film and it's all these, you know, people at the height of their physical attributes. Well, no. One of the things I learned in the book from the Square Jaws book is that Russ Meyer declared those, all of his sets, all of his shoots were sex-free zones. Which is, you know, ridiculous. I mean, he doesn't have any right to declare that.
All, yeah, director doesn't get to tell you that, first of all. Second of all, but Tara Sutana was like, no.
Right.
No, sorry. Because she famously dated Elvis, right? Mm-hmm. And his family says, like, Elvis did not know what he was doing. And I taught Elvis some lessons. And I can, and I'm sure some people would say that. And you're like, uh-huh. And I'm like, oh, I'm sure she taught us some lessons. Tara Sutana for 100% was like, no, you're doing it this way. What are you doing? Like, other girls might let you get away with it, but I'm not gonna. So I think a lot of girls have Tara Sutana to thank for his prowess.
You mentioned Tara Sutana not having like a great career, and she should have, because she was so distinctive. There's a quote I found. Quentin Tarantino apparently said in some interview he would have given up, I think he said like 2 years of, literally 2 years of his life, if he could have worked with Tara Sutana in her heyday. That's how much he was fascinated. And like, when you said it, it made me think, you imagine what it would have looked like if she had shown up in like a Sean Connery Bond film as a bad guy. Like, oh my God. Like, she
Why is she not?
Yeah. I mean, it just like, she would have just popped off the screen. I mean, we were like, oh my God.
And that's a performance. So like for me, like my gold standard performance that I hold every other performance on film up to is Tim Curry as Dr. Frankenfurter in Rocky Horror Picture Show, because that performance is genuinely one of the most electrifying things I've ever seen on screen. He has your attention 100% the entire time, and I've never seen a performance like it. I feel like she's of that level where you watch her go on screen, you're like, the other girls are beautiful, and like, but you're like, I can't look away from her. Who is this? Look at this energy. She's, I'll do anything for you. Like, I will give you, 2 years of my life. Okay. Like, it seems like not a bad deal, because she's so electric. And I'm sure there's an alternate universe where she was queen of the world, and I wish I was in that universe.
Right.
But there's also another alternate universe you and I had as the last 2 hours talking about Corey Haim. So, you know,
right.
it's like.
Exactly. I always say that's the universe where William Friedkin's Sorcerer was a huge hit, right? And Star Wars was kind of a minor.
Shit.
I mean, I love Star Wars, but Star Wars was like, oh, it was a sci-fi film that was popular. But Sorcerer, that really kept the career going. Like, that's what's that universe like?
I would very much like to live in that universe. I also want to live in the universe where Jodorowsky's Dune became Star Wars.
Oh, well, that.
Because, I mean, that's a whole other thing as well. Like, just as far as going in like a spiritual direction, like everything Jodorowsky does on top of. Okay, that's a whole other conversation. But I would just like to throw that in there.
I will tell you again, or I don't mean to get off this, but I've only seen one Jodorowsky film, and I saw the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune, but I've only seen one of his films, and that's Santa Sangre, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but the elephant scene
Yeah,
is
I know. It's a
deeply
bad one.
upsetting. And I know what you mentioned about the thing with the animals.
Mm-hmm.
I can't look at that. I just can't. And I know that he has that in his other films, and that has kept me away from Holy Mountain and El Topo, because I'm like, I don't want to, I just
In both of
don't
those
want to watch those.
films, please watch them because
Okay.
they're worth it.
All right.
You can see where it's coming a mile away.
Okay.
So
Okay.
it's not like going to be a shock to the system. Like, you'll see, oh no, this scene is coming, and you can kind of,
Okay.
and then, I would hate for you to not watch El Topo or the Holy Mountain, because they truly are some of the best movies ever made. And I'm sorry he kills animals. I really am. And
I
I, you
can,
know, and
yeah.
there's, it's, I can't make excuses for that man. Who knows? But like, he is a brilliant man, and the art is good. And what do you do? I don't know.
Yeah.
Separate art from artists. You know, you do what you can.
Well, it's, again, watching that documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune, he is fun and entertaining, and he's full of life, and all he wants to do is just devote everything to making a film. And I remembered watching, I saw in the theater, and I remembered I went with my friends, and we walked out, and I said, he seems like a fun guy to watch, but man, I don't want to work with this guy because he's probably impossible. And I thought the same thing about Russ Meyer, is that these films are so full of life, and they're so fun, and again, they're like a dirty mad magazine. But I'm like, as you mentioned, like, the shoots sound brutal. Like, you're out in the desert and it's 109, and he's making Erica Gavin run through the woods, you know, with no shoes on, to her feet are bloody, because he's like, I got to get the shot, you know? And you're like, well, that doesn't, okay, I can watch it from the remove of watching it 30 years later, and I can enjoy it. But man, that was probably not a lot of fun.
You know, it's hard, because when I had always, when I saw Fast Pussycat and Super Vixens, and I was like, yeah, I want to be a Russ Meyer girl, because I feel like I got the curves, I got the, like, the spunk for it. But thinking about that kind of shoot, I'm like, I don't know. Of course I would want to be in the film, but I feel like I'm such I don't know if he would have, I don't know. That's another universe. There is a universe that exists where I'm a Russ Meyer girl, but it's just not, sadly, not this one. Only in my brain. Although I was at a party. This was a pinnacle of my life moment this past weekend. I was at a party, and I had dressed in a Beyond the Valley of the Dolls esque outfit, and this was legit. This wasn't me dressing up in a costume. Just like, this is what I want to look like in my life, which looks like that. And I was walking across a Hollywood party, and I had a drink in one hand and a joint in the other hand. And my friend told me I looked like I was in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and I was like, "There you go. I
Life
just could
goals
check
achieved.
That box. So good. Felt really good about that."
That scene in Valley of the Dolls where Haji walks by, and she's just in black body paint.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, you're just like, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
All right. So, speaking of an alternate universe, and I know I try and stay away from these questions because they're making people try and guess what could happen in an alternate universe. It's not fair. But one of the things that I noticed, again, once he got to Fox and he made Dolls and they liked it so much, is that he did pursue other genres. Like, there was a horror script that he was going to shoot, and funny, he never made a war film, considering how much he really seemed
I
to
know,
enjoy
right?
war. You would think he would have made a war film, but he was pursuing other genres, and none of them came to pass. And What I want to ask you is like, okay, as porn became more, like obviously his career overlaps with Porno Chic,
Sure.
Deep
Deep Throat,
Throat and
Beyond
Behind the
the Green
Green
Door.
Door, and became acceptable to see these things. His films are going to get less attention because they're just not shocking anymore. Because
Right.
the culture has, if you want to define it this way, caught up with him and passed him. Do you think that after, like, if he had been able to get more projects off the ground, do you think he could have matured into it? And maybe that's not even the right term because that's like a slight kind of pejorative sound to it. But do you think he could have evolved into another kind of filmmaker because his skills were there, the directing was there, the editing was there, the writing was there, but it was just he had to get away from giant, big-boobed women running around because that was just going to not
But
be
that's not,
titillating anymore.
yeah, but that's not, that was, you said at the beginning of the podcast, right? That was the whole point. That's what he always said was the whole point.
I
Why
guess
would he ever
so,
get
yeah.
away from that, right? You look at the,
That's what he likes, right?
you look at the 7 minutes, and again, I don't think the 7 minutes is bad. I thought it was an interesting movie, but also he's just like dying. You can see him be like, can I just cut away to a big bib woman now, please, for God's sake, like just stop talking. Let me, and it, and he puts girls in there that don't deserve to be in there. They don't need to be in there at all. But he's like, I gotta get a girl in here, you guys. Come on, you're killing me. It's just guys in suits talking. So I don't think that, I don't know. I mean, I think the Sex Pistols movie is the one that the most intriguing. I was
Who
like, you
killed
got it.
Bambi? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, is it, and I, was it supposed to be a documentary? Is it supposed to be a narrative?
I think it's supposed to be narrative. Yeah.
Goodness, I can't even imagine. That sounds delightful. I don't want to sound, I don't think, I think this is it. I think this is what he does, right? I think this is what you, because you're talking about somebody who's, for the most part, had the autonomy to do whatever he wants. He could have been making different kind of movies the whole time, right? And you look at a lot of filmmakers who do that, but this is like, no, he's kind of making similar or slightly progressing, but it's still the same framework, right? How can we fit really beautiful women into this film? Because it's always got to be in there, and it's got to hinge on that. And it's just, and then some of the later ones you can see is like, how can we get to the next sex scene, to the next sex scene? Like, how are you doing it? Like, mentally, how are you getting to this next one? So I, as much as watching him do a horror movie sounds intriguing, I can't picture it.
Yeah, right, exactly, because that's his interests were joyful couplings of big boobed women, and that is going to get bogged down in the narrative of a horror movie to make it scary. I don't know. It's an intriguing thought every time it
Although
would,
big boob woman and horror movies go together hand in hand, so
Kitten Natividad could have been a great final girl if it had morphed into that. So there's just one or two other things I wanted to mention that I had here in my notes and I couldn't pass up on it. First of all, I mentioned that he called everybody a commie. Anyone who didn't like was a commie. And one of his favorite targets was fellow director Stanley Kramer, who actually we just profiled last month on the show because Stanley Kramer was a fellow member of the 166th. And he called him a commie because, of course, Stanley Kramer directed all of these social dramas that were, very from a liberal point of view. And there's a quote again in the book by Jimmy McDonough where someone says, yeah, he knew Kramer wasn't a commie. He said the reason he didn't like Stanley Kramer is because Kramer was so well respected. He was winning Oscars and
Right.
working with Gregory Peck and Spencer Tracy, and Russ is out in the desert, setting off bombs and things like that for the effect. But I just love that idea that of he's just calling Stanley Kramer a commie. And then I had to go back and think, when did I literally first see Russ Meyer? When did I first encounter him? And I think it was actually in the 1987 comedy Amazon Women on the Moon, which is that sketch comedy movie, which is very hit or miss. I find it when it hits to be very funny. Have you ever seen that film?
Not for a long time.
There's the segment where Mark McClure, Jimmy Olsen from the Superman movies, goes to a video store, and the clerk ferrets out that it's Saturday night and this guy doesn't have a date. And he says, "What's your name?" And the guy says, "Ray." And he goes, "Ray?" And he pulls a tape off the shelf that says Ray, and he hands him a tape. And the guy playing the clerk is Russ Meyer.
Nice.
And the video that Mark McClure watches features an incredibly large-breasted woman taking off her clothes, talking directly to the camera, but saying the name Ray.
Okay.
And that's the whole gist of it. And I remember thinking, I think I've seen that guy. Who is that guy? And then I looked in the credits and went, Russ Meyer. You know that name? So I love that he appears as the sort of godfather of this idea of providing large, because that's what he did in life, was providing large-breasted women on movies to watch.
If you meet somebody and they say that's what they like, I have a director for you.
Yeah,
it's nice to say, right?
That's absolutely. I said I would love. I collect. I know you collect VHS tapes. I can see the thousands of them behind you. We collect them too. We don't have a VCR, but we like them just for the visual of having on ourselves.
Buy a VCR, man. They go to your thrift store. They're not that much.
We're moving soon. So
and they just started making them again.
Maybe we'll buy a VCR for the new place. But I would love to own some of those, the original ones that he put out, because like I said, they were very visually distinctive from their graphic design. And those would be fun to own. Yeah, they're really, really nice.
Yeah, I have a whole big stack of them. When there was a video store here in LA called Arrow Video, and when it closed, I went over and their cult section, and those were the Russ Meyer movies that were left. And I was like, all right, they're all mine. So, and they bring me such joy, and they live where they should be, where they can be admired every day.
That's fantastic. Well, I mean, Julia, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for picking someone that it's not somebody that I would have like thought to go learn about, but now that I have, I'm so glad that I have a better grasp of the man's career, and I've seen about 8 or 9 of his films, which is, great. And it was just great fun watching these movies. And so I really do appreciate you coming on the show to talk about this.
Thank you for being willing to talk about a weirdo director like Russ Meyer, man. I mean, I'm sorry you had to watch all those beautiful women bounce around for hours and hours and hours. I'm sorry to do that to you.
Quite a sacrifice.
I know.
I really did like that girl that played the dental assistant in Belgevixens. I was like, it's kind of cute. Every so often my wife would walk by and just see little bits and pieces of what I was watching. She's like, "What? Which one is that?" I was like, yeah, that's this person. Yeah. That's that person. So, well, before I sign off though, I have, what I've started doing recently is an exit question for all my guests. It's kind of a nice little fanciful way of ending the show, and they're tailored to the subject and guest. And so my exit question for you is, of course, related to Russ Meyer, but specifically his leading ladies. He had a roster of leading ladies that would rival Hitchcock in terms of discoveries.
I'll say.
And so my question to you is, what Russ Meyer leading lady, if you could go back in a time machine and pluck them out and put them in 2024, which of his leading ladies, I think I know the answer to this, but which leading lady would you love to see working today in her prime?
I can't give you one. I can give you a top five. Is top five okay?
Wow. Okay, sure.
Because I can't narrow them down, because they're all amazing. I think Sherry Eubanks, who plays Super Vixen and Super Angel in Super Vixens, is so gorgeous and so fun and so funny. I think to me, she's probably the funniest of his leading ladies. I really love all the girls from Beyond the Veil of the Dolls. I think Dolly Reed and Cynthia Myers and Marsha McBroom all deserve big careers. But number one, you know it, Teresa Tana.
Yeah.
Rule the world. If she was queen of the world, I would be so happy. She would rock it. She could do anything.
She would be amazing. I actually have a Teresa Tana doll.
Do you?
My friend, Brian Heiler, who is a podcaster and he's an author, he is a major fan of Teresa Tana, and he actually got her rights. He licensed it from her family to make a 8-inch doll. And it has a beautiful box painted by a comic book artist named Joseph Linsner, who specialized in very busty, beautiful women. And I was like, Brian's a good friend, and I wanted to buy it. And then I was like, you know what? For this episode, I'm going to just spend the money. So I ordered it. So I have it.
Yay!
And I cannot wait to display it again when we move to our new location, display it. But yeah, the answer is Teresa Tana, because she is just, just
force of nature.
Completely unique in all of films. And so, yeah.
Can you imagine going to see her dance when she used to dance? Like seeing her live in person, it must have been I can imagine the looks on people's faces. She must have made, I hope she made all the money that she ever wanted.
Oh, those raccoon eyes and
I
the
know, the
black hair, the
gloves.
bangs and just, yeah, and the gloves. I
I
mean, just.
gotta do the, I gotta do Varla as a Halloween. I should get some friends together if I could do a Halloween costume for Varla. It's pretty easy, right? You just do like the gloves, the shirt, the thing. I could do that.
I love that the three of them, the three women from Faster Pussycat, ostensibly are mimicked in. There was that Pee Wee Herman movie that was the first one he did for Netflix, not the Christmas one, but he did the first one, and they get absconded, they get kidnapped by three busty women clad in black, and one of them looks like just like Tura Sitana, and
That's
I love
amazing.
that it shows up like it's great. For
Yeah.
those of you getting this joke, you're like, oh, that's fantastic. So, well, anyway, Julia, thank you so much. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internets?
Sure. So I have three podcasts. I'm on Horror Movie Survival Guide. I'm also on the Losers Club podcast talking about Stephen King and Jodorowsky. You can find me at Julia C. Marchesi on all the things. I also just did one of the last Dollar Baby adaptations of one of Stephen King's short stories. And if you would like to see it, you can message me. I can send it to you. It's pretty groovy.
Awesome. Again, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of our show at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find us on Twitter and Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. If you want to support the network, you know where to go, patreon.com/FW Podcast. So big thanks to Monique D and Donald McWaters for their support of Fade Out. So that's going to do it. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
More time. Oh, more
hey, kitten,
time.
Let's go. Where in the hell's the crew? Well, no matter. Let me check out on a historical note. A matter of military records. Borman's teeth and gums were found some years after World War II. But they never found him. Here he is. Alive and well, sweetheart. Living proof that gentle will all your steps be as you venture beneath the valley of the Ultra Vixens.
Marty! Oh, it's so much better without your teeth. Oh.
This is your follow-up. Oh, Mrs.
Be sure to watch for the further adventures of the bountiful Livonia, challenging a whole new batch of bosom buddies for horizontal honors in Russ Meyer's The Jaws of Vixen. She'll never let go.